From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Hello, and welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, host of this special edition of PCUSA. Our discussion will focus on religious freedom and how the freedom to practice one's religious beliefs and faith continues to be challenged by restrictions and even persecution in some parts of the world. Most people see religious freedom as a fundamental right, regardless of one's faith and beliefs. But throughout history, the challenge to religious freedom has presented itself in various forms. For example, recordings of one practice of execution known as burning at the stake showed in the 15th century, spreading from Babylonia and ancient Israel, then later adopted in Europe and North America. Other examples of religious persecution recorded includes the persecution of Jews by the Egyptian pharaohs. In the era of the Roman Empire, Christians were treated poorly for believing in what Rome called a superstitious religion, and during the Crusades, people were persecuted by opposing religions that included Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Between 1933 and 1945, the state-sponsored systematic murder of 6 million European Jews and Jehovah's Witnesses by Nazi Germany and their collaborators occurred. It is now known as the Holocaust. While religious freedom has shown to have a painful background, today millions of people around the world still do not enjoy religious freedom in their countries. For example, in 2017, Russia officially banned Jehovah's Witnesses and declared the organization as an extremist one. A 2017 VOA report revealed hundreds of members were subjected to raids, arrests, and prosecution. 24 members of the organization were convicted, 9 of whom had been sentenced to prison, and more than 300 people were under criminal investigation. More recently, in June of this year, the European Court of Human Rights, ECHR, an international convention to protect human rights and political freedoms in Europe, issued a landmark judgment against Russia for persecuting Jehovah's Witnesses. The ECHR declared that it was unlawful for Russia to ban Jehovah's Witnesses in 2017. Joining me to discuss the importance of religious freedom today and some of the challenges that religious organizations face, such as Jehovah's Witnesses, is international spokesperson for Jehovah's Witnesses, Paul Gillies. Mr. Gillies, thank you for joining me for this discussion.
Thank you very much, Kim. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
What can you say is behind religious persecution, and what are the usual reasons for this?
It's a very complicated question, but some factors include bigotry, prejudice, varying degrees of intolerance. It can sometimes manifest itself in hatred for another person's religious faith or their practices. It can also be generated by fear, especially when new ideas are introduced. Those who strongly disagree want to stamp out such beliefs and prevent them from spreading in order to make new converts. There could be a fear that new ideas undermine their culture or religious traditions. But interestingly, the Bible gives reasons for persecution. You go right the way back to the beginning, and Cain's killing of Abel centered around faithful worship of their God Jehovah. It all had all to do with the quality of their sacrifices. God accepted Abel's, but he rejected Cain's. Cain grew angry and killed his brother. And also in the Bible, there's a whole book of the Bible that explains the reasons for religious persecution. It's the book of Job. Interestingly, his name means object of hostility. And that book is all about the issue of integrity to God. It explains who is behind persecution. Reading the first two chapters is fascinating because it gives us an insight into a conversation in heaven when Satan, a rebel angel, claimed that people like Job only serve God for selfish reasons and not out of love. Now, the book goes on to explain that Job kept his faith despite determined efforts to break him. And that is what certainly we as Jehovah's Witnesses relate to. We appreciate what we know about God. We appreciate having a relationship with him. But we realize that persecution will result because of issues related to integrity, just like Job. Also in the Bible, there is the book of Daniel. It talks about violent persecution that was legalized by government decree. For example, it relates that 3 young Hebrew men were thrown into a fiery furnace because they defied the world ruler at the time by refusing to bow to a national symbol, which was against their conscience. Only worship should go to God. And then Daniel himself was thrown into the lion's den. Why? Because he was praying to his God. And then you have the book of Esther, King Ahasuerus' persecution against the Jews in general. And the Jewish faith would be very familiar with that decree to carry out genocide at that time. But fortunately, that effort was thwarted. So there are a number of reasons why persecution can come about.
And thank you for presenting those examples that are in the Bible. Can you talk about religious persecution historically in considering persecution that took place in the first century, the 17th century, and even in modern times? Is there a common thread as far as intent?
Yes, there are common threads. These are principally recorded in the Bible book of Acts of the Apostles when you want to do a comparison with the first century. But Jesus himself warned his followers that they would be hated. He said to them, "You will be hated by all people on account of my name." So in other words, they would be hated because of what Jesus' name represents. And he also said to them, "If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also." He went further by saying, "Everyone who kills you will think he has offered a sacred service to God." That's amazing. Now, when Christianity started, after Jesus' death and resurrection at Pentecost, there was an explosive start to Christianity. 3,000 were converted to Christianity in just one day. And the next chapter shows that that led to 5,000 people converting. Now, that worried the religious leaders at that time, who felt that Christianity was filling Jerusalem. And the testimony of false witnesses led to the murder of Stephen at the hands of Saul. Now, he was at the time a Pharisee who spearheaded a wave of religious persecution before his conversion. So the persecutor, Paul, then became the persecuted. He was likely killed in Rome. And apostles were killed. James was executed by Herod Agrippa. Peter was imprisoned, another one of the apostles. And John was imprisoned on Patmos, where he wrote about the persecution in the book of Revelation. Now, why? Preaching about Jesus and what he represents was one common thread. Jesus, as we understand from the Bible, is the King of God's kingdom, which means the government that will take over rulership of the earth. What the people pray for in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come." And then there is political charges. A very careful consideration of Acts chapter 24 shows that political charges were brought against the Apostle Paul. His accusers said he was stirring up seditions. He was championing a religious sect of the Nazarenes. Now, false witnesses testified against him. So you can see even from that example that the early Christians were labeled as a sect because they were a new religion, so to speak, as far as they were concerned, and a dangerous one at that because of the charge of sedition. Now, Paul successfully argued that he was being judged because of teaching about the resurrection, not for political reasons. Nevertheless, those kind of charges seemed to develop. In the time of Nero, Christians in Rome were thrown to the lions for refusing to perform ceremonies that venerated Caesar. They refused to celebrate state holidays. They refused all military service. And that, too, was a reason for persecution. Interestingly, The Rise of Christianity, which is a book by E. Barnes, says that no Christian became a soldier and no soldier after becoming a Christian remained in military service. So that stand of the early Christians in the first century is the basis of why Jehovah's Witnesses today are conscientious objectors when it comes to military service. Also, another very interesting development we saw there was Jesus and the Apostle Paul were faced false accusers. Now, we see a trend whereby horror stories are published in the news media, accompanied by false or misleading information. And this is designed to shape public opinion. And then pressure is put on politicians to do something about the so-called damaging beliefs or practices.
In looking at the history of religious persecution, and you brought out some very good examples as are portrayed in the Bible, how does it compare to what is happening to Jehovah's Witnesses today, for example, in Russia and other countries that persecute Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, some of these trends are still evident in modern day examples. Right from the time of the First World War, those who were taking the lead in preaching the good news about Jesus and the good news about God's kingdom were put in prison. Here in the United States, some of those taking the lead were put in prison in 1918 and sentenced to 80 years, and they were released and exonerated after 9 months. But then in Britain, they were imprisoned for conscientious objection during the First World War and again during the Second World War. You mentioned in your introduction the Nazi extermination of 6 million Jews under the Holocaust, which was a tremendously horrible record of killing. The Jehovah's Witnesses were one of the first in the camps, starting in March 1933. About 1,500 of Jehovah's Witnesses died during the time of the Holocaust out of some 35,000 witnesses who were living in Germany in Nazi-occupied territories. Now, close to 400 were executed and another 1,000 died because of the terrible conditions in the concentration camps and in prisons. But the reason why they were persecuted during the Nazi period was fundamentally the same as the time of the Apostle Paul. They remained politically neutral. You see, we believe that Jesus said true Christians must remain no part of the world. And when he gave that instruction, he explained the reason why, because he wanted to promote love and unity that binds Christians together. So political neutrality preserves our international love and unity. Jehovah's Witnesses living under Nazi rule obeyed the laws of the land, but they were neutral with regard to political issues. So they refused to serve in the military. They refused to support the war efforts. They wouldn't vote in elections or join Nazi organizations. They wouldn't salute the swastika or even say Heil Hitler. These were some of the reasons why they were put in prison, and they continued to practice their faith. So they were totally opposed to all the Nazi principles and our core religious beliefs. Just one example, the Nazis promoted extreme racism, whereas we're opposed to racism in any form, including the genocide of Jews and others. Now, interesting too, as far as Jehovah's Witnesses were concerned, we were the only religious group with our own camp symbol. That is the purple triangle. And Jehovah's Witnesses could be freed from the camps as long as they signed a pledge renouncing their faith and cutting ties with fellow believers. Professor Robert Gerwarth, in his writings, concluded that Jehovah's Witnesses were the only group in the Third Reich to be persecuted on the basis of their religious beliefs alone. Now, that doesn't mean to say that Jehovah's Witnesses felt as though they were the victims. Rather, after Nazism collapsed, they viewed themselves as victors because they understood that Christians would be persecuted. They understood the issues that related back to the Bible book of Job. The Third Reich, during that period, Jehovah's Witnesses were labeled as communists. A few years later, under communism, they were called fascists and supporters of American imperialism, whereas the real reason for the persecution under both systems was their absolute Christian neutrality and refusal to compromise their freedom to worship and to preach in public. So under the, say, the Stasi era in East Germany, around about 1950, they started to be arrested again in Eastern Germany. 6,000 approximately were arrested, 4,000 convicted, sentenced to 15 years to life imprisonment under that era. And then under the communist era of the Stalinist period, there was mass persecution too in Russia. Now, that's a couple of examples. We could mention other countries if we had time, places like Cuba, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Malawi. In course of time, it became a capital crime to bear the name of Christ, and large numbers of Christians were put to death. But a change took place around 313 of our common era, because for political reasons, Constantine issued the Edict of Milan, which actually established religious toleration within the Roman Empire. And Constantine eventually made Christianity the privileged religion of the Roman Empire. The problem was you had two divisions, the Byzantium and Rome, each claimed to be the home of the true church. And both were intolerant of those disagreeing on doctrinal points. The persecuted then became the persecutors, especially when churches became the official state religion. And the Encyclopedia Britannica makes a comment on that by saying that by the 4th to the 8th centuries, church bishops declared the minority of dissenters as heretics with a view to eliminating them as enemies of the state, not just enemies of the church, but also the state. And then under people like John Calvin, he led a Protestant reign of terror. When his theology on predestination and the Trinity was challenged, a man named Michael Servetus was tried as a heretic and burned at the stake in October 1553. So in France and Germany, they experienced ferocious religious wars in the 16th and 17th century, atrocities being committed by Catholics and Protestants alike. You had what's been dubbed the burning time in England during the reign of Henry VIII in the 16th century and his daughter Mary. And those burnings were all related to differences in beliefs as far as doctrines of the Catholic Church was concerned. And then William Tyndale, he was strangled and burned at the stake in October 1536. His crime? Translating the Bible into common English.
In looking at the situation of today, can you explain a little bit more the ban on Jehovah's Witnesses in Russia and why they were labeled extremists?
Well, after the fall of communism in 1991, Jehovah's Witnesses were exonerated from the persecution under the Soviet period. But then there was an explosion of growth of believers, and the Russian government then started to show a determination to ban Jehovah's Witnesses from 1995 onwards. There was a ban in 2004 in Moscow, which was overturned by the European Court in 2010. Then you had the development of the law on extremism in 2006. A very vague concept of incitement of religious discord, to quote the law on extremism. And in 2007, all prosecutors were ordered to investigate Jehovah's Witnesses. At that time, a number of our publications were deemed to be extremist. And the reason they gave was because they said that we claim to be the true religion. Of course, I believe that most religions would say that anyway. And because we use God's name, Jehovah, in our Bible, the New World Translation. Which is strange because the Russian Makarios Bible uses God's name 3,500 times. These conclusions were based on expert studies often performed by people who are not specialists, made-to-order studies as noted by some sociologists. Even one of our banned extremist publications was My Book of Bible Stories, which is a book written to explain the Bible stories in simple terms to children. The law on extremism forbade banning sacred texts such as the Bible. The way around that law was simply to claim that our New World Translation of the Bible wasn't a Bible, so it was banned. And then on April the 5th, 2017, the Supreme Court banned the activity of the Administrative Center and 395 local religious organizations. There was a nationwide ban on all legal entities and confiscation of properties. And the court at the time said that Jehovah's Witnesses individually were still free to practice their religion. This only affected the legal entities, the ban. But that's certainly not the way that it's turned out, with the many raids and imprisonment of up to 350 people, and also problems associated with employment, bank accounts, and so forth.
How does your organization respond to these aggressive actions against your activities?
In a word, peacefully. We use diplomacy, and sometimes we'll organize letter-writing campaigns. For example, when the ban came in Russia in 2017, Jehovah's Witnesses worldwide felt for their brothers in Russia, and about anything between 25 and 40 million letters were sent to the Kremlin in support of Jehovah's Witnesses in Russia. We don't engage in protests. We don't engage in civil unrest or disobedience to secular authorities. We use diplomatic efforts to resolve issues. And sometimes delegations, where possible, will meet with officials to discuss issues and address misunderstandings. And in fact, that approach has resolved a lot of religious intolerance in a number of countries around the world.
And we'll take some time now for a quick break. And when we return, we will continue our discussion with guest Paul Gillies, international spokesperson for Jehovah's Witnesses, on the challenges of religious freedom. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is international spokesperson for Jehovah's Witnesses, Paul Gillies. I'm Kim Lewis, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also find us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Now back to our discussion on the present challenges to religious freedom with guest Paul Gillies, international spokesperson for Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, Mr. Gillies, earlier this year, the European Court of Human Rights issued a landmark judgment in favor of Jehovah's Witnesses. What are some specifics of this judgment?
Well, that was in June the 7th, 2022, when the European Court declared that it was unlawful for Russia to ban Jehovah's Witnesses in 2017, that it was illegal to ban our publications and also our website, jw.org. And Russia was ordered to discontinue all pending criminal proceedings against witnesses and to release all those in prison. In addition, the government was ordered to return all the confiscated properties, or to pay the equivalent of approximately 60 million euros in compensation. The judgment also criticized the Russian authorities and established that they were prejudiced, showed bias, and had not acted in good faith, to quote the judgment. And they also criticized the law on extremism as something which had been strategically drafted in a very broad and vague manner that allowed the authorities to act arbitrarily against Jehovah's Witnesses. And they also said that the forced dissolution of all religious organizations of Jehovah's Witnesses in Russia disclosed indications of a policy of intolerance by the Russian authorities towards the religious practices of Jehovah's Witnesses, designed to cause them to abandon their faith and to prevent others from joining it. They mentioned other procedural flaws, such as when the Supreme Court relied on biased expert reports selected by the police and prosecutors instead of reviewing the publications impartially.
And what impact have these judgments had on Russia, and what can you expect in the future?
The impact? None whatsoever. Russia withdrew from the Council of Europe on March the 15th, 2022, and since then refused to recognize any of the European Court judgments. A recent application that our people made to the Supreme Court for recovery of losses sustained by the theft of our property was rejected by the court without even a hearing. So we don't know about the future. We can't predict it. But if Russia rejoins the Council of Europe, perhaps they will abide by court decisions. We will see. But we continue to see raids, arrests, criminal trials, currently 106 in prison. And despite the fact the European Court said that they should release them, we've got disabled people in prison. We've got people over 70. We have four who were sentenced just this past week to 6 years in prison because of their religious activity. And that's interesting because when you compare the penal code of Russia, the maximum sentence for kidnapping is 5 years and rape is between 3 and 6 years. And yet we can get up to 6 or 8 years for carrying on our religious practices.
What is the status of people's bank accounts that were frozen, including other financial restrictions?
Well, independent reports have shown that prosecutors and investigators have had hundreds of Jehovah's Witnesses added to an official list of terrorists and extremists. You know, many have been added to the list before they've even been charged with a crime. And being on this list means that their bank accounts are blocked, causes them problems in finding employment, obtaining insurance, buying or selling property, and a range of other financial activities. And they experience reputational damage as they are publicly identifiable as being terrorists or extremists. This list is the same list where they put IS sympathizers or Al-Qaeda operatives on.
The Russian government is said to favor the Russian Orthodox Church. What are relations like between the Orthodox Church and other Christian groups, including Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, back in 1997, there was a law on freedom of conscience and belief which created a two-tier religious system, where Russia recognized what they called traditional religions, the Orthodox Church, Jews, Muslim, and Buddhists. So the Russian Orthodox Church is allowed to practice its religion freely, and I understand it's the only so-called Christian religion that's allowed to do so. But we have anti-cult movements which are supported by the Russian Orthodox Church. In recent weeks, representatives of that movement even accused Jehovah's Witnesses of plotting to overthrow Putin and labeling us as a terrorist organization, without, I may say, presenting any proof, which is quite amazing considering our long record of peaceful and non-political activity. And that expression, which is emotive, a cult or sect, is reminiscent of the first century, as we mentioned earlier, designed to instill fear that ideas are dangerous or they're a threat to the culture or traditions of another country. I may add that years of a propaganda campaign against Jehovah's Witnesses that spanned decades under the Soviet Union still leads to suspicion, being viewed as non-traditional, even foreign, or a threat to society. And some of that language we see repeated in Central Asian countries too.
Well, before we leave the subject of Russia, can you elaborate on how the European Courts of Human Rights judgment refuted all of Russia's claims that the actions, beliefs, publications, Bible translation, and JW.org website promote extremist views?
Well, Jehovah's Witnesses are peaceful people whose beliefs and practices are harmless, and that was reiterated by the court. And they also said that state authorities have no right to review the legitimacy of their beliefs. A very interesting quote from that judgment says this: "The court reiterates that respect for religious diversity undoubtedly represents one of the most important challenges to be faced today. For that reason, the authorities must perceive religious diversity not as a threat, but as a source of enrichment." These are good values for many different countries too. As far as the specific findings, the Russian courts did not identify any word or deed or action by the applicants which would be motivated by violence, hatred, or discrimination. That was one of the points they made. And the court reiterated that the right to try to convince one's neighbor is an essential element of religious freedom.
Besides the false claims you mentioned, are there other misconceptions that sincere people may have regarding Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that question. Perhaps one that relates to the theme of our program is that Jehovah's Witnesses are intolerant toward other religions or even people with different lifestyles. Whereas we follow the Bible, and the Bible's advice is to respect everyone, regardless of their religious beliefs. For example, in some countries, there are hundreds of thousands of Jehovah's Witnesses in places like Mexico, Brazil, or Nigeria. But even so, we don't try to pressure politicians or lawmakers into restricting or banning the work of other religious groups. Nor do we campaign to have laws passed that would impose our moral and religious convictions on the general community. That is because we try to live by the golden rule mentioned by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount: all things, therefore, that you want men to do to you, you also must do to them. So that's one misconception. Another misconception, again, in the context of what we're discussing, is that we force people to convert. Well, as our magazines have clearly stated, pressurizing people to change their religion is fundamentally wrong. And in fact, conversions made under compulsion are actually meaningless, because God only accepts worship that comes from the heart. So forced conversion doesn't allow people to love deeply from their feelings and emotions. We believe that people should be allowed to take in knowledge so that they can make an informed choice, but we certainly don't coerce people into changing their religion. Jesus himself never pressurized people to accept his teachings. When he instructed his followers to share their beliefs with others, he said, "Try to establish a peaceful relationship with them and avoid confrontation." So those are two misconceptions.
What tends to be the general response in trying to show what the truth is regarding these misconceptions?
Well, we use the Bible to explain our beliefs. We publish that on our website for anybody to have a look at. We try to show more by our actions that we practice true Christianity by treating people in a respectful and dignified way. We do have a reputation around the world for being peaceful, honest, and law-abiding citizens. But as far as the general response is concerned, it depends whether they prefer to believe the misconceptions or they're open to reason. What springs to my mind is what one writer exclaimed: "Prejudice is a great time saver," he said. "You can form opinions without having the facts." So if people want the facts, then we're pleased to explain that to them.
I'd like to get your response to one last question before we wrap up our discussion. Why should the audience care about religious persecution or persecution in general?
Well, I would think that the listeners listening to this program do care about religious persecution. They're showing an interest in this subject. But freedom of religion is like the foundation of a building. Other freedoms, whether they're civil, political, cultural, or even economic, are built upon that foundation. So if the foundation is undermined, then the whole building suffers as a consequence. Whenever religious freedom is violated, we often notice that other freedoms are the next to suffer. So if other freedoms are to be protected, religious freedom needs to be safeguarded first.
We are out of time and we'll have to end the show on that note. I want to thank our guest, Paul Gillies, International Spokesperson for Jehovah's Witnesses. Thank you for your insight on the challenges to religious freedom and for sharing some experiences of Jehovah's Witnesses, including persecution and even victories over some of those persecutions for their beliefs. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join us next weekend for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.